This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
So the question he asks is, why do you think the West is very silent when it comes to the Palestinian conflict? Because as Monbois put it, he's one of the political philosophers, he says that America has not acted strategically. America has never acted morally consistently. It's always acted strategically consistently. So in other words, it's not in the West's interest necessarily to do anything for the Palestinian cause. Joe Biden, who is now the president, before then, he said if there wasn't an Israel in the Middle East, we'd have to make one. They realized the importance of having influence in the Middle East in countries like Pakistan, you know, and countries like Afghanistan. We've seen all of these things before. And this is where you guys have to be careful because, frankly speaking, you know, the West doesn't have any military bases in this area anymore, right? It used to have military bases here and then was removed. It used to have military bases in Afghanistan. Now it's been removed. It doesn't have any military bases in Iran. So the entire area and in Turkey has NATO bases, but not any US bases. So you don't really have military bases. Then you have Russia and China, which are two opposing powers. I think the West is now starting to become a little bit anxious about the situation. And so their second order of business, so the West has two strategies, and it's always had two strategies. We call hard power and it has soft power. Hard power is through the geopolitics, and soft power is through ideological warfare. And the second part of it is where we'll influence people like me and you, our people in this university. Because the way they dispense that particular kind of soft power is through things like Netflix, through things like the media, through things like education. And so what you'll have is, you'll have, you know, the movement away from, for example, hard power kind of politics to try to kind of manipulate you into thinking the way they think. Because if you sympathize with the West in Pakistan and you support them, then you're more likely to do what they want. So that's why I would say, just bear that in mind. The West does not act in a way that would benefit you. The West acts in a way that benefits themselves. Let's take one other example. So we already see the Palestine example. Let's take one other example. Let's take the feminist movement in the West as an example. The feminist movement in the West, if you do a data analysis on the talking points of the feminist movement in the West, you'll see that some of the main things they've been speaking about, for example, relate to equal pay, abortion, and these kinds of things, correct? But we've seen women decimated and annihilated in Palestine recently. 20,000 women and children have been killed. In Kashmir, we've seen the rape and the oppression of women. In the Rohingya province, we've seen the rape and the oppression of women. The Uyghur Muslims, which are all close by to where you live, we've seen all of that. My question is, to what extent have Western feminists shown any care for that comparative to equal pay and abortion in the West? Yet, they're dispensing, if you like, Western feminism to Pakistan or Western liberalism to Pakistan. They're selling you an illusion, making you think that if you act like them, talk like them, dress like them, be like them, that somehow you will get the same kind of rewards as them, that they will accept you. But the truth is, they don't care about you. For the most part, they're indifferent. For the most part. Now, of course, many people have been on the roads and streets protesting, you know, from the liberals in the United Kingdom and the United States, to give credit where credit is due. However, for the most part, as a comparison, even the populations, for the most part, have not shown that kind of care. Indifference, if you compare it, pound for pound comparison. Pound for pound comparison. So what I'm saying to you is, you've got to start thinking properly now. Because the notions that the West is best or white is right, these kinds of things are being drip-fed into our systems through Netflix, through series, through movies, through education. And this is where the warfare is. Before, there was colonialism. And it was very direct. They would come into your country and say, we're going to take it over. Now we have groups of people who are volunteering to be colonized by the West. Groups of people in the Muslim world who are saying, I will adopt your way of life. I will try and be like you, try and have the same beliefs as you. And the irony of all ironies is that they're not respected by Western people for the most part. People are voluntarily putting themselves under the boot of the white man. Or in the case of colonial feminism, the white woman. This is not liberation, criticality, thinking clearly and so on. This is actually a kind of subjugation. That's how I see it. And that's where the fight is. That's where all of us have to be careful. That's where it concerns us directly. And so that's where it starts. We have to expunge from our own systems and our own communities these notions, these colonial notions, which are making us more sympathetic towards the West and its projects and its ideologies. I've noticed something about the higher echelons of Pakistani society. Now, Pakistan's a big country, the second most populated Muslim country in the world. And if you think about it, right, if you did a referendum or you did some kind of polling data on what people actually believe on social issues, you'll find that people are quite conservative on as a whole, comparative of course to the West, there's no doubt about that. But if you look at the top 1% of income earners, if you like, in Pakistan society, there's a different dynamic going on. And I have noticed this dynamic all the way from Karachi, all the way through here to Lahore, and up to Islamabad and other places in Pakistan. And the dynamic is that the proportionality of traditionalist versus, if you like, liberal is actually a little bit different. And the more and more I have conversations with people, of course I don't have studies to back this up because there's no studies that can be done or have been done on this issue, the more I've realized that it's an odd state of affairs where the traditionalist Muslim or the religious guy or woman would feel a little bit alienated by some of these people who have been, if you like, convinced of the Western project. Let's just call it what it is. And so they feel alienated. They feel like they are weakened. They feel like they can't be themselves. And in fact, if they try and express any kind of traditional values, that people from a more secular leaning will attack them. Not physically, of course, you know. I think that needs to change, frankly. Because those people from that kind of leaning, with all due respect to them, they have volunteered to be colonized. They have volunteered to be subjugated by the West. So why are they in a position to tell the traditionalist Muslim that you should be doing this, that, or the other? I don't think they really are in that kind of position. And so I feel like the dynamics need to change. That's what I feel like. And this is something very well known. I mean, in the Quran, this is actually even alluded to, where Pharaoh, فَاسْتَخَفَّ خَوْمَهُ فَأَطَاعُوهُ, you know, he humiliated his people so they obeyed him. It's a very interesting verse. فَاسْتَخَفَّ خَوْمَهُ فَأَطَاعُوهُ. He humiliated his people so they obeyed him. The West is humiliating, you know, the East in many ways, orientalizing them, otherizing them. And they feel like the only way to respond to that is to culturally capitulate to them. Say, okay, well, we'll do whatever you do then. If that's the case, if that's your response to the West, then you're not in a position to tell me as a traditionalist Muslim, for example, what to do. If you want to volunteer to be a slave, then you can't act like my master. That's how I see it. And so I think you need to change the dynamic, and the way to do that is to have confidence in what you believe in. And it's not just by what you wear and what you say, it's how you say it and what you do. You see? So another way of doing it, frankly, if I met, and I have met many of them throughout the Muslim world, the way I would do it is argue with them. If they really feel strongly about how they feel, why is it that, for example, the Muslim has to justify his position, the traditionalist has to justify his position? Why isn't it that the feminist must justify their position, for example? Like if I were to ask a feminist, can you prove on a philosophical and rational or epistemological level your ideology from bottom up to be true as an objective truth? They wouldn't understand half of what I've said. And if they tried to respond to me, they would make a mockery of themselves. I think so. Because why have you accepted an ideology like liberalism or feminism or atheism or whatever it may be, and you don't even understand how to prove it? I thought that you were trying to be critical. So if we're going to be critical, we have to employ the same kind of criticality that you did in the first instance with Islam. Employ the same kind of criticality with liberalism and feminism. That's only fair. You did that with Islam. You were saying, okay, well, let me question the assumptions and the presuppositions of Islam. Okay, fine, let's question them. But let's also question the assumptions and the presuppositions of feminism and liberalism. Why not? Why are you afraid to engage with the truth claims of these ideologies? Why do you just want to be underneath the foot, the crumpling foot, the stamping foot of the white colonist? And so that's why I say you need to start engaging these people, in my opinion. And some of them will be flagrant about it. In a country like Pakistan, they'll mention things like homosexual rights. And they'll say there's nothing wrong with being homosexual. Okay, that's a position, isn't it? If you're saying there's nothing wrong with being homosexual, that's a moral and philosophical position. I'm happy to argue with you on that position. But you have to be ready to argue. So how do you argue? Yes or no? If it's right or wrong to be homosexual? Tell me where your starting point is, for example. What's your morality that you're basing right and wrong on? They'll say the harm principle, for example, if they know what that means even. Because frankly, I've noticed that in the Muslim world in general, the liberals and seculars and feminists you find are two-bit wannabe liberals. They don't even know what it is. They're two-bit, the BTEC version of it. You know, like you have the real deal authentic version, and then you have the phony version, like the replica one. You know, you have like a Rolex and then you have like Timex. You know, you go to the market in Lahore and the guy has got Puma and it's spelled wrong. I was just eating in a restaurant and I was drinking coffee and I looked out the window and it said Marks and Spencer's. And that's meant to be an English store. I'm sure you saw that, right? It says Marks and Spencer's. And I knew that was not Marks and Spencer's. You can say you're liberal all you like. You're not actually a liberal because you don't even know what it is or how to justify it. You can say you're a feminist all you like, but it's unlikely that you're going to be able to do this work in justifying your ideology. It's unlikely. Just call yourself what you are. Just say this. I'm a muqallid. I blindly follow the West. Just say that. Be honest with yourself. Because I see them as successful. They have tall buildings and clean streets. I want to be successful as well. Therefore, I'm going to call myself a liberal. I'm going to just follow the talking points of the white man or the white woman. Be honest about the situation. Because if we had that discussion of why is homosexuality right or wrong, we can put Islam fully to the side. If you wanted to speak about Islam, if you want to claim to be a Muslim, if you want to, then the argument is not even an argument. But putting Islam to the side, justify on secular ethical grounds why you think homosexuality is a moral position. You see, in the West, there are two kinds of ethics. Okay? There are two kinds of ethics. Really, there are three, but two prescriptive ones. One of them is called consequentialism. All right? And the other one is called categorical imperatives or deontological ethics. These are two, if you like, schools of thought. The third one is called virtue ethics. That one is not prescriptive, so I'm not even going to speak about that. And by the way, I do like virtue ethics. I mean, virtue ethics is not problematic for me. It's, for the most part, I think it's good. It was first written by Aristotle, and there was a book called The Nicomachean Ethics and stuff, but that's something to the side. It's not prescriptive. It doesn't tell you what to do and what not to do. It has a lot of wisdom in it, in fact, virtue ethics. But consequentialism is the idea that something is wrong because of its consequences. Something is wrong, why? Consequences, okay. And deontological ethics was put forward really by Immanuel Kant. And that one says, if everyone in a society done something, if the society will be dysfunctional, then that thing should be wrong. So for example, for Kant, suicide was wrong, because if everyone done it, the society wouldn't continue, right? He said lying was long because if everyone lied, we wouldn't be able to transact with each other. Do you see? Okay, so let's bring homosexuality as a case study. Remember, these are the only two real schools of thought in all of Western ethics outside of religion. What do you have? You have consequentialism, and you have the other one, what's it called? Deontological ethics. Are you with me? So consequentialism says that something is wrong because of what? The consequences. The first question is, who gets to define what the right and wrong consequences are? Anyway, let's just say for the sake of argument, for the most part, they would say a bad consequence is harm, physical harm. Physical harm for whom? The individual or the community? Really, they would say both. For the most part, especially utilitarians, because utilitarians believe in the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And that's it's a liberal principle, really. Okay, no problem. The greatest good for the greatest number of people. Let's examine homosexuality. Why not? Not using Islam. Not using the Bible. Not using the Bhagavad Gita. Not using this religion or that religion. Let's use Western ethical principles. Isn't that only fair? Yes, it's fair. Okay, go ahead. Proceed. So let's really assess the societal harms. Statistically, homosexuality causes or spreads more diseases than heterosexuality. Is that true or not? Of course it's true. According to most organizations, even the NHS, the National Health Service, they say a homosexual is 15 times more likely to get AIDS. 15 times. That's just one example, but there are many things like it. It's a consequence, isn't it? Yes. What kind of consequence is it? Is it positive or negative? Would you agree it's a negative consequence? Sure. All right. We look at some sociological studies. We start to see, what does a homosexual household look like? Huh? What do the children end up being like? And almost every study that I've seen, without any exception at all, shows that the child is more likely to have pathological disorders. Psychologically, they'll be disrupted. More likely to be delinquent. More likely to achieve less in education. There are so many negative things. In fact, I have a conversation with one demographer. His name was Nicholas Wolfinger. Okay, you can see this online, and he's got peer-reviewed works. And I asked him, so, okay, we know this. What is the best and most prosperous type of family according to your research? He's not a Muslim. He's an atheist, in my understanding. He said, objectively, it's a nuclear family. Objectively, it is a religious nuclear family where the people in that family are practicing religion continuously. That's what he said to me. If you want to follow the West so much, well, I've got all these studies from the West, from the white man himself, from your God and your prophet. I can tell you all of them. And this is one of them. So I'm saying, okay. So from a family perspective, it's negative. From a medical perspective, it's negative. And we don't even want to talk about the military perspective. I recently saw a video of the US Army, and it started off with a lesbian girl inside there. And she was like, when I decided to join the US Army, and then she went through an LGBT story and whatever. And then they put right next to it the Russian Army video. And you had these men shooting guns and climbing the wall and this and that and join the army. Now tell me, when the Russians are watching the recruitment video for the US Army, tell me, are they going to feel fear? If I knew that I was going to be fighting a group of, sorry to say, transgenders. Because when you remove your testicles, you remove the testosterone that comes with those testicles. And it's objectively the case that when you have less testosterone, you're weaker physically, objectively. That's why steroids are not allowed in sports. Because they are testosterone, they give you an advantage. So you have homosexuals and who might have 15 times more likely to have a disease. And you have transgenders who have removed their greatest assets. And now they're going to go against the Russian army. Self-sabotage. So militarily, it doesn't make sense. Familiarly, it doesn't make sense. All of these things, you cannot argue from a consequentialist perspective, since you told me that's your morality, that this brings about more good than harm. You cannot argue. Tell me how. Well, because these people are going to be happy. We don't know if they are going to be happy, because if they have AIDS, the question is this, because they're more likely now to have AIDS, syphilis, gonorrhea, testicular warts, genetic warts, syphilis, all of this, more likely, they're 20 times more likely. Tell me, if you ask them, are you more happy now? What are they going to answer? What about a transgender? And we have many books written on the issue, irreversible damage and this one and that one. How many people that when they do the SRS surgery, how many of them are happy with that? How many of them regret it? But it's irreversible damage. You're cutting it off. You can't go back and it's been disposed of, thrown away. You can't get it back and stitch it back on. It's finished. You're telling me there's more happiness in this area than there is sadness and dystopia and consequences and harm? I don't believe you because the evidence is against you. So from a consequentialist perspective, you can't make an argument. I don't think so. But when we go to a deontological perspective, it gets even worse. Because if everyone was homosexual, there'd be no human beings. So in the same way as Kant said, if everyone committed suicide, there'd be no human beings. If everyone was homosexual, you have to do the same thing. There'd be no human beings. Because after two or three generations, how's it going to work? It's going to be reduction of human beings, at least, and then dearth, and then maybe extinction of human beings. So it doesn't promote society to do this. So from both of the Western paradigmatic perspectives, I'm sorry to say there's no argument. So now that we've defeated the idea or the proposition that homosexuality is a legitimate morality, from an ethical liberal perspective, because liberalism is based on utilitarianism, social liberalism, and that's a form of consequentialism, since we've defeated it, tell me what's the evidence that you have now? You don't have any evidence, do you? You just want to do it. You just want to do it. You just want to be like the white man. You just want to copy the white man. So just admit it. If that's what you want, just admit it. You're impressed by them, aren't you? You're not very impressed with yourself. You're insecure. That's what you have. You have insecurity issues. You have deep insecurity issues. So you're not a rationalist. You're just fundamentally insecure. And how could this fundamentally insecure person twist the religious guy's arm into thinking, oh, you know, you should follow what I follow and do this? How can you accept this? When you realize the weakness, the psychological weakness of the Goro complex, Pajit, whatever they call them, right? So, what are you doing? What are you doing? Then there's no way they can bully you or try and make you feel uncomfortable. So that's what I would say about, I don't even know what question I was answering there. Let's go to the next question. You see, when someone identifies with what they were formerly, you know they have a psychological grudge. Like, for example, if I had a wife, and then I divorced her, and then you ask her, what are you? She goes, I'm an ex-Mohammed hijab wife. Now, that might be justifiable because of my status and my status. Who I am, that's fine. She might want to just mention that. But usually, if someone does that, it's a very weird thing to do, isn't it? What are you? I'm an ex-such-and-such wife. We're not asking you to define the negative. We're asking you to define the affirmative and the positive. Someone to define as an ex-Muslim, you have to say it's atypical, isn't it? I mean, I don't define, you say, what are you? I'm a I'm a non-atheist. I'm a non-Christian. Who does this? Only someone who's still affected by the thing. And that shows you the power of Islam. That is so powerful that even when they leave it, they still have to mention it in their description. There's no way of getting away. Islam for them is like a shadow. They're trying to run away from it, but they can't do it. And that's an indication that they're not actually secure about their beliefs. It's like when, for example, let's be honest, right? If one of the guys here had a friend and you asked him, what are you? And you say, I'm an ex such and such husband, yes? What would you think of such a man? He's not over her, whoever she is. Wouldn't you think that? Honestly, I would think that. I say, what on earth are you talking about, my friend? He's not over her. He's embittered. He's resentful. He's jealous. He's this. He's that. All the negative emotions. So someone to define themselves as the next Muslim, Muslims should see this as a flattering thing. So it's not over us. He can't get us out of his mind. Can't get Islam out of his mind. So that's how I would deal with the situation. You got to look at the psychological cues here. It's very odd. Like, there's many people that convert to Islam in the West. You might know that. Hundreds of thousands, millions. Millions on an annual basis. White people as well. Just in case, you know, if that changes anyone's mind here. But I'm just saying, no, it's true. When you ask them, what are you? You know what they say? Muslim. If you ask them, like, what kind of Muslim, they say convert, revert. That's how they answer. I've never once met one of them. And I ask them, what are you? And they say, I'm an ex-Christian. I've never seen it. Because they're comfortable in their new persona. I've met literally thousands of them. I've not seen ex-Christian. I've never heard this before. Might have been around, but it's not trending in the same way that ex-Muslim is trending. So yes, I think that these things are certainly an indication of the power of Islam itself. Next question, inshallah. Let me tell you, you answer one of his questions, no problem. Yes? But then you ask him your own questions. Because the one who asks the question has the power. The one who asks the question has the power and has no problem answering a question. But if you are in a situation in da'wah, in school, or in life, whereby you are just being asked questions, you're no longer in a conversation, you are in interrogation. Just remember this. Don't accept to be interrogated. Why? I'm not under review. You're not my judge. You're not fit to be my judge. So remember this. You need to start thinking about the questions you want to ask them. And I've done that with Piers Morgan, for example. No, it's true, because I know his tactic. He's going to start interrogating me and stuff. I say, fine. I'll answer a couple, but I have to throw some back. And you'll be surprised. Because if they don't answer your question, what happens? They look weak. They do. You have to have your own questions. I've learned that in marriage as well. So where were you last night? Huh? So this and that. So why do you have to keep going to Pakistan and this place and that? Who are you going with? Huh? The real question is, then whatever I want to ask, right? The real question is, even if I did do what you think, what would be the real problem in that? Huh? What would be the moral? How can you argue on a consequentialist perspective or on a categorical? You can't argue. So what I'm saying is start asking questions. That doesn't mean badger someone or humiliate them, but I'm saying don't accept to be interrogated. That's what I'm saying. Next question. Yeah, I don't think the white man will accept him, because if a gay Palestinian died in Gaza, he would look at him in the same way as he looks at all the other Muslim ones. If a gay or a lesbian, quote-unquote lesbian, you know, woman from Kashmir was raped by some man, they would have the same indifference. If a Uyghur gay died, they'd have the same indifference. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, why is it that we identify? I mean, look, we call people gay. We say the LGBTQ community, right? We say this. But I have a question. Why is it that we identify someone with their sexuality in the first place? Now, let me give you an example, right? You might have someone who's black person, but at the same time, they like men and they're a man. So he's part of the black community, he's part of the homosexual community. He could say this himself, he's part of both communities. But why is it that you identify yourself with your sexuality? Now, I'm not saying you should or you shouldn't, I'm just saying why. Like, for example, I like to eat chicken. I don't say I'm part of the chicken eating community. You see, I like women. I don't say I'm part of, you know, the heterosexual community. I don't say that potentially or particularly. So the first question is, why is it that this is even a community that's identified in this way? It's a question. But what I'll say is, in the assumption of your question, is this presupposition that we should care about how everyone feels in a society. The truth is, who cares how an ex-Muslim feels, with all due respect, or how a Muslim feels? The law doesn't care about how anyone feels. Like, for example, I'm driving the car and it says 30 miles an hour. Unless you're in Lahore, I feel like I want to push that button. It doesn't matter how I feel. There's laws and regulations. And they are actually underpinned by something called a social contract. So how people feel, once again, this is not a therapy session. This is a country. You know? And it's not like we have to respect how everyone feels. That's not how it works. In all cases, that's a hedonistic understanding. It's like, I'll do anything that comes to mind. I'll do anything that I want. Just go, just do it. These are all liberal principles. But they must be themselves proven. Like, the hedonistic principle is unproven. It's called the hedonistic principle. It's unproven. So prove that principle first before we say, okay, well, why is it that this and that? We don't agree with the assumption of the question. So what I'm saying is, you know, ex-Muslim, this, that, whoever, homosexual, it's not about necessarily how they feel. It's about how they deal with their emotions. There's lots of things I want to do. Like, for example, Islam allows you to have four wives. A one man, four wives. Yes? At the same time, by the way, just in case anyone doesn't know that. Now, Islam doesn't allow you to have intercourse and copulate with whoever you want. Yes? I, or you, or anybody else, maybe I feel like I want to copulate with every woman. Sorry to say I. Well, I want to be here and do the zina and this. So I feel like I want to do that. It doesn't matter because there's laws and regulations. I always said I've made the comparison between incest and homosexuality. Because both of them are like the harm principle, right? At the end of the day, when it comes to the harm principle, incest is as legitimate as homosexuality. Someone could say, I have a very strong attraction with my sister or my brother. At the end of the day, most societies would consider that to be abnormal or incorrect. They would consider it to be abnormal or incorrect. However, according to the harm principle, one could argue, so long as they're not harming anybody else, why can there not be brother and sister, or even brother and brother, or sister and sister, in a sexual relationship? It's the same idea. A true liberal will say, you're right. And a lot of them have said that, but I've spoken to. So you're right, and therefore incest should be legal. That's what they would say. Some of them, who have had conversations with homosexuals, and I've said this, I made this point to them, they get very angry. Say, how dare you compare homosexuality and incest? I say, just look at it from a principled perspective. Put emotions to the side for a second. The reason why you said homosexuality is okay is because of the harm principle. You said, so long as these people are not harming anybody else, they can do whatever they like. I'm saying the same exact logic can be applied to a brother and a sister. So long as they're not harming anybody else, what's the problem? We're using your same principle. Because one of them said it's not natural. I said, what did you say? Can you repeat that again, please? It's not natural. You're making an argument for what's natural and what's not natural. You see, they don't really have an argument against this. The only difference between homosexuality and incest is homosexuality had a movement in the 1960s where gay people, quote unquote, would walk in the street hand in hand and demand their rights. And brothers and sisters have never had that yet in the West. That's the only difference, my friend. So I want to know, this is Beacon's Weather, what's this place called? BNU. You might have a LGBT community here. I don't know if you have one. The society even. We are the LGBT society. I will say, it's very unfair that BNU, being a liberal institution, has a LGBTQ society, and they don't have an incest society. How dare BNU not discriminate against the incest? Why is it LGBTQ and it's not LGBTQI? There's a brother and a sister out there that just love each other. But you don't care about their feelings. You only discriminate against them because they came out of the same womb. And maybe some of them want to go back into the womb, sorry to say, in a different way. How dare you discriminate against these people that just want to have fun and love their brother in a non-platonic way, or their father or their mother? Oh, it's disgusting. How can you talk about this? What do you mean? You don't like this? This is where society is heading. When the white man will decide incest is okay, the Pakistani liberal will say, oh, he said it's okay. But when it's okay now, we must have been incestified. You shut your mouth, you slave. You shut your mouth. You don't know, you see, you don't know why the white man said this. And you followed him. You took his advice, and look at you now. I spoke to one liberal, Lars Gull, in Norway. And I said to him, what about animals? Sorry to say, bestiality. And he said, yes, animals is fine. Like a dog, for example. A donkey. Huh? You have many donkeys here. So what are you going to have? When I come to BNU, 10 years from now, I'm going to see a stable of donkeys. And the humans standing next to them. Say, this is part of the bestiality society. Because these people said it's okay. Come on. Come on. This is servitude. This is docility. This is subordination. This is slavery. This is intellectual molestation.
You're being said
intellectually molested. It's true. It's true. Stop it. Stop being intellectually molested. Stop it. Shake it off you now. Let this speech be some kind of an awakening for you. The white man doesn't respect it. The white man doesn't care. He's got his own life. He does not care. He's not impressed. I guarantee you he's not impressed. If you died, you wouldn't care. The people who care about you are your family members. Honestly, your people, your community, they care about you. The Muslims. This is how it is. The Palestine issue has shown us that. The masks have all dropped. You think they don't care? They don't care. So there's no benefit in copying them. There's no benefit. With that, we'll conclude, inshallah.